I think we should start.
Yes.
I think
Yes.
we're good.
Okay. So,
all right.
Bakasha. Okay, Simi, let's go part 4 of 5. Migiletta, they're just around the corner.
Okay, so I'd like to bring us back to where we started, where we left. We hadn't entirely finished what we were looking at last time. So I'm going to share the screen here and just remind you where we're up to. We were talking about the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. Now, remember what we started with. I just, again, want to keep everything in perspective. Next week, we will wrap up with the question of, does Megillat Esther have a happy ending? But we started with the fact that the text of Megillat Esther is problematic from a literary point of view, or it's a complex text. It has a text and a subtext. Because it is a text that is written with the awareness that the non-Jewish world is reading over our shoulder, which means certain things are obscured or sort of hidden, okay, or accessible only to the reader who is sensitive to certain kinds of nuances. The next thing that we looked at was the will to power of Ahasuerus and the fact that all of the non-Jewish personalities in the story who are highlighted by the text are motivated by power hunger, and by a desire to control others. Even those that appear benevolent or things that appear benevolent are not. And there's a very great cruelty at the heart of this society, which I'm hoping to show you as a reflection of a pagan worldview. We'll come to that next week, Bezrat Hashem. Meanwhile, we look at a relationship between Mordechai and Esther, which is troubling or potentially troubling. This is the source that we were looking at last time. I believe we were up to this part, which is Esther Dalid, Aleph through Chet. We'll come to that in a minute. But basically, we pointed out that Mordechai is in a position of there seems to be a potential for abuse of power in the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. We pointed out that both Mordechai and Esther, certainly Mordechai, and we saw all the signs of this in the biblical text and in the Midrashim, Mordechai is a man who has no power, right? And that is manifested in his loss of his tribal identity. It's manifested in the fact that the word Galut is repeated over and over again. We see it clearly in the fact that he has to adopt Esther to begin with and take care of her. These are two people who are functioning with no power. Esther is taken away. He can't prevent that. Esther is taken to the harem. In that, he shares a common fate with also the non-Jewish world at that time. But He has no control. He has no sovereignty. He has no possibility. He doesn't have citizenship, so to speak. Right? He's a refugee. He's an exile. What is very interesting is that he also stands in a unique position relative to Esther. He is father. He is mother. He is husband. He is both religious authority for her and also her, if you will, her leader, right? In other words, and we see that the word tziva, commanded, is used several times in relation to his relationship with Esther. He commands her not to speak, right? He commands her not to speak. She is silent because he had commanded her not to speak. In other words, that word appears in a number of places. Now, if I'm going to stop here for a moment, I just want to make sure that I don't repeat myself. I believe, by the way, I can't look at chat. I'm sorry. I'll take questions at the end. I believe we were up to this, but if we read it already, I would like somebody to let me know. Okay. So I'm going to read this and then we'll stop. We'll stop for a second. I'll stop the share and just thumbs up or thumbs down. Okay. We are now in a, we are now reading in Perek Dalet, which is over here, which is, if you see, I've highlighted it in last week's sources. And we are reading the section after the decree has been made by Haman. We're going to come back to Haman a little bit later in the Shi'ur. But at the moment, we're looking at the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the decree and Mordechai's reaction to it. Okay, let me just stop the share for a moment. Is that what we were up to, ladies and gentlemen? Yes,
we were talking about the clothing and the emphasis on the clothing and the change.
Right, that's it. Right, but did we talk about why Esther's reaction is so strange? Did we talk about that? No.
No.
Okay, so we'll go to that now. Let's take a look at it. I'm sorry that, but I seem to. I don't know. I wasn't sure. Hang on. Let me just get it over. Okay, so this is in the aftermath of the decree having been made, and we're reading Mordechai's reaction. We're seeing the agony that is caused by this decree reflected through him. Mordechai yadait kol asher nasa. Mordechai knew all that had been done. Ve'kra Mordechai et begadav, and Mordechai tore his garments. Ve'ilbash sak ve'efel, and he put on, he clothed himself in sackcloth and ashes. And he went down into the middle of the city and he cried a great and bitter cry. And he came up to before the gate of the king. Because one is not permitted to come to the gate of the king in sackcloth. Okay. This, by the way, is an echo of something we see with Yosef. When Yosef is summoned to appear before Paro, it says in the Psukim that before he can appear before Paro, he has to be barbered, he has to be, you know, groomed, and he has to change his clothing. You can't appear before a king in sackcloth. And in each and every province, a place where the word of the king and his law reached, Evel Gadol Ayudim, there was great mourning for the Jews, Vitzom Vachim Sped. Fasting and weeping and eulogizing. Sak va'efer yutzal rabim. Many people were wearing, or sackcloth and ashes were spread out on many of the people. And the maidservants of Esther and her chamberlains came. Vayagidula, and they told her. They told her that Mordechai was wearing sackcloth and ashes. Vatitchalchal hamalka me'od. And the queen became very sick. Actually, Batit Chalchal, the Midrash says she actually had a miscarriage. She gets very, very sick, right? It's a reflexive, emphasized noun. Batishlach begadim lehalbish et Mordechai ulhasil sako me'alav velo kipel. And she sent garments to dress Mordechai and to remove his sackcloth from upon him, and he did not receive them. Now, this is extremely strange, if you think. The expected reaction here would not be that she sends clothing and tells him to change his clothing. We would expect her to say, Mordechai, what's going on? Now, Esther is a bird in a gilded cage here. Of all the people in the city of Shushan, she is the one who least knows what's going on. The common man out on the street knows a great deal more than she does because she's in this, like I said, gilded cage. The decree is going out. The news is spreading. People are yelling and screaming and crying about it. Esther knows nothing. Mordechai knows everything. He knows just how bad things are. But Mordechai rends his garments, sackcloth and ashes. We talked about that last time, about the significance of sackcloth and ashes and the connection to the Yosef story. As we will see repeatedly, the Megillat Esther alludes to the Yosef story. It was written very much with the consciousness that the Yosef story is a sort of foreshadowing of the story of Megillat Esther. And we'll talk about that as well. But what is very striking is that Esther knows nothing. Now, we would expect her, when she hears that Mordechai is wearing sackcloth and ashes, we would expect her to send a message as they have a conversation by a messenger, right? Saying, Mordechai, what's the deal? What's going on here? She doesn't do that. What she does is she sends clothing for him to change. And the question is why? And here, I think we will see as we go on, we see that for Esther, and quite possibly this is a motif that occurs, that runs through the whole story of the B'nai Rachel, the children of Rachel, that is the tribe, Yosef, Binyamin, the tribes of Yosef and Binyamin. The motif of clothing as something more than just garb, something more than just garments. Okay. It's almost as though Esther believes that if Mordechai changes his clothing, the situation will change. And where does this idea come from? That seems to be like, which is why she really gets agitated when he refuses to change his clothing. If clothing, you know, we say clothes make the man. This is taking that to a really great extreme. What, in what sense do clothing make the man here? Or do they make the man? Generally speaking, we are accustomed to think, please mute yourself if you're not muted. I'm getting feedback. Generally speaking, if we think about clothing and its significance in Judaism, it's not supposed to be the main thing, right? And in fact, as we pointed out, the Tanakh is not very visual or very cinematic in its depiction of what people wear, or in fact, any physical details. So this seemingly strange belief that if you change your clothing, you change the situation, that Esther seems to have, is very, very strange here. Okay, so let's go back to the Psukim. Okay. Okay. Here we are. Hang on. Okay. I'm sorry, where are we? Okay, so he refuses to take the clothing and change. And Esther called to Hatach of the chamberlains that the king had placed before her, and she commanded him about Mordechai. Only now does she want to know, to find out what is this and what's it about. And Hatach went out to Mordechai at the street of the city, to the street of the city in front of the gate of the king. And Mordechai told him all that had happened to him. And the apportioning of the money that Haman said to weigh into the king's treasure houses for the Jews to destroy them. And a copy of the writ of the law that had been given in Shushan to destroy the Jews, Mordechai gives to Hatach, להראות את אסתר, to show to Esther, ולהגיד לה, and to tell her, ולצוות עליה לבוא אל המלך להתחנן לו, and to command her, there's that word again, to command her to go, to come to the king, to plead with him, ולבקש מלפניו עלמה, and to request from before him about her people. Okay, now, there are a number of questions that we can ask here, but one thing I think is very important, if we want to understand what's going on in this conversation, is some pretty harsh things get said to Esther in this conversation. We have to remember that this is not Mordechai and Esther speaking in the same room, complete with tone of voice, body language, facial expression, and a one-to-one-on-one conversation in which it's much easier to clarify what you mean and what you're saying. These are verbal messages being delivered through a servant, right, with no nuance. And you can't even write anything. You don't want to have any written evidence of what this conversation is. So we have a situation where Mordechai and Esther are communicating in a very, very artificial way. Okay. And Mordechai has just commanded Esther to go out there and plead to the king. Okay. I want to take a look now at Bereishit Rabbah, which draws a parallel here to the story here in Megillat Esther, and brings us back to the Yosef.
I'm just going to interrupt you because we did this last week.
We did this. Okay, so then we'll skip. Thank you. Okay, so let's go now to Esther Dalet. Let's read a few more psukim and we'll keep going. After Mordechai commands her to go to the king, thank you very much. That was very helpful. And Esther said to Hatach, and she commanded him to Mordechai, Kol avdei ha-melech. I'm sorry, wait, I'm supposed to be pointing on. Here we are. Kol avdei ha-melech v'amedinot ha-melech yodim. All of the servants of the king and the peoples of the provinces of the king know. Asher kol ish v'isha asher yavo el ha-melech el chatzer ha-pnimit asher lo yikarei. That any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner courtyard, who has not been called, hatato lahamit, his law universally is to be put to death. Apart from the one to whom the king wills stretch forth his golden scepter, and that person will live. And I have not been called to come to the king for 30 days. Okay, so what is Esther saying here? And this is really, really important. And still, when Mordechai says to her, go to the king, she may be afraid for her life, but primarily she's saying something else, which is extremely, extremely important, which is, I am not in good favor with the king right now. He has not called me for 30 days. You can imagine that Ahasuerus is getting progressively more and more ticked off at this woman for not telling him who she is, probably in addition to whatever other things he presents or is angry about. What she's saying to him is, we need to think about this, right? Let's make a plan. What she's saying to Mordechai is, I'm going to run over there. I'm going to tell him to spare my people. And what if it doesn't work? You just used up your ace. You just used up your wild card. You know, like, this is not a good plan. Okay. Mordechai's reaction is extremely harsh. And they told to Mordechai the words of Esther. And Mordechai said, to answer Esther, do not imagine in your soul to escape in the house of the king from all of the Jews. Because if you are surely silent at this time, space and salvation will come to the Jews from a different place. And you and the house of your father will be lost. And who knows if for just a time as this, you reached royalty, you came to be royal. We're going to stop here for a moment and think about what Mordechai has just said to Esther. First of all, his words are extremely harsh. Also, very, very ironically, he says to her, "Ki im hacharish tacharishi ba'et hazot, if you are silent at this time." He has drummed into her, commanded her, repeatedly told her, she must not speak. For her to be saying, she must not tell Ahasuerus who she is. For her to be saying now, wait, before I speak, we need to think, is only reasonable. And yet he seems to suspect her of not caring about the fate of the rest of the Jewish people and being willing to sacrifice them because she will be saved. Where does that come from? Well, here I would like to suggest that actually Mordechai is saying something harshly and strongly, and again, he's not saying it in person, which makes it worse than it should sound, right? It's much more complicated than it should be. Mordechai is saying to her, Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yudim imakom achil. Estelle, the Jewish people will be saved, whether or not you go to the king. Va'at uveit avich tovedu. You and your father's house will be lost. What's he referring to when he's talking about her father's house. For him to say you will be lost makes sense, but what do you mean your father's house will be lost? They're from the same family, right? What is Mordechai saying to Esther? He's saying, Esther, I am not worried about the Jewish people. One way or another, the Jewish people will be saved. I'm worried about you. You will fall off the face of history. You will cease to be relevant. You will be sidelined. There will be no Megillat Esther, because that's what the book is called, right? You will have done nothing. You will have disgraced your father's house. Now remember that Mordechai and Esther, and we will see this in the continuation of the Shiul, Mordechai and Esther from Binyamin, they're from the house of Shaul. And Shaul made a tragic historic error, which we will also look at, when he spared Agag, the king of Amalek, after he had been commanded to destroy him, and Shmuel Aleph in the book of Samuel. Estelle, this is your chance to fix it. If you don't do it, you will be lost. God will take care of the Jewish people. That's what he says to her. And here, even though he's speaking very harshly, what he's essentially saying to her is, I'm worried about you. What does Estelle say to him? Here we are. And then we will look at Estelle Abba. Sorry, I'm not very good at. Okay. But Tomer Esther Lashiva El Mordechai, and Esther said to answer Mordechai, Lech kenos et kol ha-yudim ha-nimtzaim b'shushan, go and gather all of the Jews who are found in Shushan, v'tzumu alai, and fast for me, v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim laila v'yom. Do not eat and do not drink 3 days, night and day. Dam ani v'na'arotai atzum ken. Also I and my maidservants will similarly fast. Uvechen, and thus, with this, avo el hamelech asher lo chadat, I will go to the king against the law. V'kasher avadeti, avadeti. And if I am lost, I am lost. What does Esther Abba say here? This is what we look at. V'tomer Esther la'ashiv el Mordechai. Esther said to answer Mordechai. Amra lo, she said to him. Lech kenos et kol ha-yudim ha-nimtzeim b'shushan v'tzumu alai v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim. Go gather all of the Jews who are found in Shushan, fast for me, and do not eat or drink 3 days. Eilu hen. These are the 3 days. Yud gimel v'yud dalet v'tetvav b'nisan. The 13th, the 14th, and the 15th of Nisan. Shalachla. He sent it to her. This is the Midrash, adds the rest of the dialogue here. One of the days you're asking us to fast is the first day of Pesach. Amralo, she said to him, Zaken sheb Yisrael, elder in Israel. And I think the vowels here are wrong. I think it should be read this way. Lema hu Pesach. What is Pesach for? No Jews, Mordechai. No Pesach. If the Jews are killed in a decree, by the decree of Haman, there will never be Pesach again. Miyad shama Mordechai v'hodali v'areha. Immediately Mordechai listened and acknowledged her words. Hadahu dichtiv, that is what is written. The last pasuk here. Vayavo Mordechai vayas kichol asher tzivta. I love Estelle. Mordechai passed, and he did all that Estelle commanded him. Now, what's going on over here? Who's the rabbi? Who's the spiritual leader, religious authority? Who's the boss? Nobody. Nobody's the boss. The relationship between Mordechai and Esther is not and has never been about power. Estelle listens to Mordechai when he commands her not to speak because she trusts him. She trusts that he has her best interests at heart and that he's giving her good advice and that he knows what he's doing. And so when he says, Estelle, I command you, under no circumstances are you to tell anybody who you are? First, when she's taken to the king's house, and then afterwards, when she's chosen by the king, still keep it under wraps. We are powerless people. We have to keep our head down. We have to, our only defense is silence. Okay? She listens. Not because of an imbalance in their relationship, not because he's the boss, because of power, because it's an expression of a desire to control her, but because she trusts him. And when Estelle says to him, I will go and I will risk my life and I'm ready to do it, but I have to have backup. And the backup is spiritual. And that means the Jews have to be behind me. They have to fast. They have to pray for 3 days, even if it's the first day of Pesach, right? You have to back me up and I will go. And she insists. What does Mordechai say? You got it. Why? Because now that she has taken the responsibility for this position, for this action that she is going to take, Mordechai completely trusts her. And in fact, from this point on, till the end of the story, we never see Mordechai instructing Esther in any way. In fact, she takes a dominant role. And we're not going to look at this because we won't have time. But there is a fascinating midrash in Masechet Megillah. And if you like, I can post it on the site for you to learn on your own or to look at on your own, where after Esther, you know, she goes to the king and she invites Haman to the feast that she's making for the king, right? The Gemara asks, what was she thinking? Why did she invite Haman to the feast as well as Ahasuerus? You're all familiar with the story, so I'm not going to go into detail. And each one of the Tanaim and Amoraim, each one of the Talmudic sages gives a different answer to the question. You know, she's trying to lull him into a false sense of security. She's trying to make sure that the Jewish people keep praying because they won't rely on her. They'll keep doing what they have to do spiritually. She is trying to make Ahasuerus jealous. I mean, there's about 9 or 10 different opinions there. And 9 or 10 different opinions. What was Esther thinking? And they're all very, very interesting. At the end, one of the Talmudic sages approaches Eliyahu HaNavi. This happens sometimes. And the Talmudic sage runs into Eliyahu HaNavi and says, what was God thinking back then? We were arguing about it in the Beit Midrash. What's the real answer, right? And similarly here, what was Esther thinking? And Eliyahu's answer is she was thinking like all of the Tanaim and Amoraim, like all of the Talmudic sages, meaning what? Esther doesn't have a clear plan. This is not a situation in which you can have a clear plan. She's going to have to play it by ear. She's going to have to see, you know, create potential for possible ways of exploding this, you know, relationship between Haman and Ahasuerus, creating opportunities to nullify the decree. She's doing something that will open up possibilities that she can exploit, right? But what she's doing is it's like a spy going into the enemy headquarters, right? You know, she's going in there on her own, knowing only that she has the backup of everybody else, and she's going to find a way to change the situation if God helps her, right? Mordechai trusts her. He doesn't say a word. He doesn't say, okay, now I want you to do this and I want you to do it this way. No. The fate of the entire Jewish people in the civilized world from India to Ethiopia, which was the Persian Empire, was everywhere, right? Rests on the trust and the love between these two people, right? And Mordechai, clearly, Esther commands me that we must fast. You got it. Whatever you need to do the job, you do it. And I'm behind you. Because it's not a relationship of power. It's a relationship of mutuality, of love, of trust, of a common belief in the rightness of their path. And as I and I think it is one of the hidden themes of Megillat Esther. Contrast that to the relationship between Ahasuerus, Vashti, Haman, and Zeresh. Haman and Ahasuerus, and you get a very, very different picture. And I think it is, again, a reflection of a pagan worldview, which we will talk about, as I said, as we go further. Okay, so now let's just move on to one more point here, which I think is important, and so we'll sort of round out what happens here, how we understand what happens here. After Esther makes her commitment to go in and do the job, right? And she, it's a shame we don't have more time to explore this because it's the dialogue between her and Ahasuerus is truly, truly fascinating. But as I said, we don't really have time to explore it. What I want to show you here is something that is very sort of critical. After the 3 days of fasting, right? Vayi bayom ha-shlishi, and it was on the third day, batilbash Esther malchut. Esther put on royalty. Right, she dressed herself in royal garments. And she stood in the inner courtyard of the king's house, nochach beit hamelech, facing the king's house. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal palace, nochach petach habayit, facing the opening to the king's house. By the way, this phrase, and the king was sitting on his royal throne, it could come straight out of our tefillot, out of our prayers for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I mean, it's very evocative to the Jewish reader. Chazal are bothered by something here. The sages of the Talmud are bothered by something here. Even before that, I think we can we have to ask ourselves why we get told Vatilbash Esther Malchut. Esther put on royalty. We can assume that Esther dressed very, very carefully for this interview with Ahasuerus, right? She picked her clothing with care as part of her preparation for what she's trying to accomplish. So why do you tell me that she put on royalty? Masechet Megillah, the Talmud asked the following question. Vayi bayom ha-shlishi, vatilbash Esther malchut, and it was on the third day, Esther put on royalty. It should say royal clothing, not royalty. Royalty is an abstract noun, right? You can't put on royalty. You can put on your royal robes. You can't put on royalty. That's like saying she put on justice. You can't, you know, you really can't say that. Okay. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Chanina. So the Rabbi Elazar said in the name of Rabbi Chanina, Milame, this teaches us, shelav shita ruach hakodesh, that she clothed herself in the divine spirit. And the proof text for that is from Divrei HaYamim, k'tiv hacha batilbash. It says here, she clothed, meaning she put on royalty, uchtiv hatam, and it says in Divrei HaYamim, when it talks about Amasa ben Yetel, one of King David's warriors, viruach lavshet amatai, a spirit clothed Amasai. I'm sorry, viruach lavshet Amasai, Amasai ben Yetel, a spirit clothed Amasai. Which means that, what are Chazal saying here? For Estelle, the clothing she puts on is a state of mind, a state of spirituality. It represents something. It symbolizes something. And we're gonna talk about that, as I said, a little bit further. Bereshit Rabba says something else. Vahi bayom ha-shlishi batilbash Esther malchut. On the third day, Esther put on royalty. Lavsha malchut beit aviha. She put on, she clothed herself in the royalty of her father's house. She is a descendant of the first king of Israel, King Saul, Hamelech Shaul. When she goes to Ahasuerus, with echoes of Vashti here, right? When she goes to Ahasuerus, she is not going as a supplicant who is pleading for her people. She is going as a queen. I am royalty. I am the descendant of a king of Israel anointed by God. You don't mess with me, Ahasuerus. I come to you with my lineage, my pride, my heritage. I come to you with the divine spirit clothing me. I come to you, I'm wearing clothing, but I'm wearing much more than that. I am much more than that, and I am clothed in much more than that. And in fact, Estelle is, from this point on, there's nothing passive about her. She's magnificent and brilliant. And she toys with Ahasuerus, she manipulates him, she solves the problem brilliantly. Again, from a position of complete lack of power to a position where she really, really catalyzes events in the way that she wants to. Okay, I want to make sure we have time for questions. So let's go on now to our next set of sources here. Okay, so this is the second thing it's a short thing that I sent out. Let's just remind ourselves where we are now. Okay, there's we've been building certain themes. Now we have to look at the relationship between Haman and Mordechai, or Mordechai and Haman, more accurately, because this is actually quite problematic and disturbing in certain ways. So let's take a look at that. And the first thing we have to look at, of course, is the verses. Okay, so let's take a look. If somebody is not muted, please mute yourself. I'm hearing myself in my own whatever. It's making me a little crazy. Okay. For this, we have to go back a little bit. Oh, I'm sorry, I opened the wrong thing. Hang on, stop share. Let me open the right thing. Here we are. For this, we have to go back a little bit to before the decree. Before the decree gets made, this is the beginning of Perek Gimel, chapter 3. The king Ahasuerus elevates Haman over the other ministers. And we'll start reading here. It's interesting. I believe it is the Malbim, 19th century commentator. I think it's he who says that the king wants to deflect the resentment of the people to Haman. He's nervous about getting assassinated. So he does that. But it doesn't matter. Let's keep reading. After these things, the beauty pageant contest, whatever sicko thing Ahasuerus does there, and his marriage to Estelle. Gidal HaMelech Ahasuerus et Haman ben Hamdata. The king Ahasuerus made Haman, the son of Hamdata, Agagi, the Agagite, descendant of Agag, the king of Amalek. He made him great, Vayinaseu, and he lifted him up. And he placed Haman's chair above that of all of the other ministers that were with him. And all the servants of the king that were in the gate of the king bowed and prostrated themselves to Haman, because thus the king had commanded Haman. In other words, it's a royal decree that everybody has to bow to Haman. Lo yichra v'lo yishtachabe. And Mordechai would not bow and would not prostrate himself. And the servants of the king that were in the gate of the king said to Mordechai, Madua ata over et mitzvat hamelech. Why are you violating the king's commandment? They are not seeing this as a conflict between Mordechai and Haman. They don't see this as a rivalry between two ministers of the king. They see this as one of the ministers of the king, or somebody in the administration of the Persian Empire, simply ignoring the commandment of the king that everybody bowed to Haman. It's a great question. Why are you violating the commandment of the king? Vahi ki omra melav yom vayom, and it was when they would say this to him day after day, v'lo shama lehem, and he did not listen to them. Vayagidu lahaman, and they told Haman, lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai, to see if the words of Mordechai would stand. Yehigid lahem asheru Yehudi, because he had told them that he was a Jew. In other words, Mordechai does something here that would make any diaspora Jew intensely uncomfortable. He disobeys the king's commandment, and the other ministers are telling him, you should, you know, really be listening to the king and bowing to Haman. And he ignores them. And they say to Haman, he's not bowing to you because he's a Jew, which means that Mordechai tells them why he's not bowing to Haman. And they told Haman to see if the words of Mordechai would stand, meaning Mordechai seems to have explained some reason for why he's not bowing to Haman. And he's claiming that it is part of his being a Yehudi, a Jew. And here comes to my mind the most interesting thing. And Mordechai saw that Haman did not bow and prostrate himself to him. And Haman was filled with wrath. And it was disgraceful in his eyes to send his hand out against Mordechai alone, because they told him who the people of Mordechai were. And Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews in all of the kingdom of Achashverosh, to destroy all the people of Mordechai. Okay, and then what does he do, by the way, to determine the day that he's going to destroy them? He casts a lottery on the first day of, on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and that's Pasuk Zayin, and until he comes to the month of Adar. Okay, he doesn't pick a date for destroying the Jews. He casts a lottery. Okay, this is all very, very strange. And one of the things that disturbs, or that the Midrash points out here, is, so we're going to be looking now at another source, is the following. We'll go back to the first source in a minute, but this is the source that's called Haman in History. Take a look at Esther Rabbah here. Okay. Okay. What did Mordechai say to those who said to him, why do you violate the commandments of the king? So this is incomprehensible to his fellow ministers. Rabbi Levi said, Amar lehem Mordechai. Mordechai said to them, Moshe Rabbeinu hizhir lanu b'Torah. Moshe, our master, warned us in the Torah, prohibited us. Arur ha'ish asher yaseh pesel u'masecha. Cursed is the man who will make an idol or a molten image. V'rasha zeh oseh atzmo avodat kochavim. And this wicked man turns himself into an idol. V'yishayahu anavi hisviranu, and Isaiah the prophet warned us. Hidlu lachem min ha'adam asher nishama ba'apo. Remove yourselves or quit the company of a person who has his soul in his nostrils, because he is not considered anything. Somebody is, please mute yourselves. Okay. And not only that, and not only that, I am a nobleman of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All of the other tribes were born in Chutz La'aretz. And my father, Binyamin, was born in Eretz Yisrael. Amarunle, so they did. V'nemarle, should we say this to him? You want us to tell him that? Miyad v'yagidu l'Haman. Immediately they told Haman. Amar lon Haman. Haman said to them, Amarun le, say to him, Skeno halo ishtachave liskeni. His grandfather bowed to my grandfather, Yaakov bowed to Esau. That is what it says. Vatigashna hashfachot v'gomer v'achar nigash yosef v'rachel v'yishtachavu. Yaakov, this is in the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. Everybody bows, right? Yaakov bows, his wives, his concubines, not concubines, I'm sorry, the shfachot, Bilhah and Zilpah bow, their children bow, Leah bows, her children bow to Esav, and Yosef and Rachel bow. Everybody bows. Heitiv, Mordechai answered, Va'adayin lo nolad Binyamin, but Binyamin was not born yet. Amarin le, they said to him, this is what they told Haman. We're going to look at the other opinions here in a minute. But I think what's very, very striking, and this midrash for me helped underline something that always bothered me. Mordechai is not bowing to Haman. Why doesn't Haman rat him out to the king? Why doesn't Haman arrange a nice little quiet assassination? Why doesn't Haman just kill him himself? He's not going to get into trouble. Why doesn't Haman speak to Mordechai and say, you must bow to me? Why does he conduct this conversation by means of the other ministers? This is like this game of patball going on here. Who's higher up here? Haman is higher up here. Haman is the one who should be in control of this situation. If anybody knows how to exercise power, it's got to be Haman. That's, you know, that's his name.
A man named Richard is unmuted, and that's what's ruining the sound.
Richard, if you could mute yourself, I would be grateful. Okay. So why is Haman doing this? This is a big question here. And by the way, I just want to point out, if we go back to the Haman and Mordechai page, this happens twice more. Actually, it happens once more, I should say, but it's a similar pattern. This is after Haman has been, I'm jumping back and forth a little, but again, I know that you all know the story. So, you know, I think it should be possible to do this. If you take a look at what happens after Haman has been invited to the queen's feast, only me and the king were invited to Esther's feast, right? He's walking out, he's walking on air. He feels very, very up there. He's very happy with himself. And by the way, this is after the decree has been made. Mordechai is a dead man walking. All the Jews are dead people walking, right? He should not be, there shouldn't be anything going on here that disturbs him. What does it say after Haman, having received the invitation to appear at the queen's feast and appearing at the queen's feast, Vayetzeh Haman bayom ha'hu sameach v'tov lev, and Haman went out on that day happy and good of heart. And when Haman saw Mordechai at the gate of the king, lo kam v'lo za, he didn't get up and he didn't move. Lo za mimen, he didn't move in his presence. Vayimale Haman al Mordechai chema. Haman was filled with wrath at Mordechai, right? Here he is. He struck a blow against the Jews that should decimate Mordechai, take all the juice out of him, destroy him completely. Mordechai doesn't even look at him. And the pasuk tells us, vayitapek Haman, Haman controlled himself, vayavoel beito, and he came to his house, vayishlach vayaveto havav et zeresh ishto, and he went and he sent for those who loved him, and Zeresh his wife. Vayisaper lahem Haman et kvod ashro v'rov banav, and Haman told them the honor of his wealth and his many children, and all that the king had made him great and had elevated him over the ministers and the servants of the king. And Haman said, even Queen Esther did not bring with the king to the feast that she has made anyone but me. And also for tomorrow, I'm invited with her to the king. V'chol ze einenu shoveli, and none of this is worth anything to me. V'chol et asher ani ro'et Mordechai haYehudi yoshev b'shar haMelech. As long as I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the gate of the king. Well, why not? Why not? Look, clearly, I mean, you know, if we want to get psychological about it, he's very insecure. He has to pump himself up. He has to puff himself up. He has to say, I'm this and I'm that. And he has to surround himself with the people who admire him, his hangers-on and his followers, the people who are going to be impressed with him. Okay. Mordechai's a dead man. Why doesn't he just kill him? Like I said, arrange a nice, discreet little assassination. By the way, what does he in fact do? He goes to the king to get permission to kill Mordechai. And of course, that's his downfall. But what's very, very striking here is that he doesn't ever go against Mordechai directly. And I would like to suggest that what the Midrash is highlighting for us here is that Haman is afraid of Mordechai. Haman is afraid of Mordechai. He's afraid of Mordechai because Mordechai is very, very secure against Haman. Tell him, please, somebody, Richard, if it's you, if it's not you, somebody else, wait, let me see if I can, hang on. Let me see if I can mute all. Okay, that should be better. Mordechai is not afraid to go against Haman. He's not afraid. Haman is afraid of him. And when Haman attacks Mordechai, it has to be indirectly. He has to kill all the Jews and include Mordechai in that, right? He has to go to the king and get the king's permission. The casting of the lots, the asking his, we didn't read those psukim, but we will. I want us to just take a few minutes for questions. It's very, very clear that paradoxically, Mordechai is more powerful than Haman. And that's what we're gonna next week we will continue the sources that we're looking at here. We're gonna continue the sources that we're looking at here, and we will sort of wrap up all the themes together when we ask the question, does the story have a happy ending? Okay, I'm not looking at chat because like I said, I can't. It makes me crazy. If anybody has a question, we have a few minutes for questions now. Questions take precedence over comments. So any questions that anybody wants to ask?
You had said earlier that Mordechai had no power, but he's Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech early on.
He is Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, but let's put it this way. He starts out completely powerless. That his position is extremely precarious is clear from the fact that the king allows Haman to make this decree against the Jews, right? If, you know, there were Jews in Germany who were in positions of great influence, even politically, but when Hitler rose to power, it didn't save them, right? So yes, he does have power, but it's very, conditional. It's very
precarious. Precarious.
Absolutely precarious. It's very interesting. There's a book by a non-Jewish historian called Timothy Snyder, where he talks about that and how it was. I mean, it's called Black Lands, I think. Fascinating. I don't agree with everything he says in the book, but one of the things that he says is that the reason that Jews were so easily destroyed was because first they were disenfranchised, their political power. Any political power, limited political power they had, was taken away from them. They weren't citizens. They didn't count. And so you could dispose of them. Any other questions?
Simi.
Questions first.
In the chapter where it says where Mordechai is wearing is levush sak, and Esther has her chamberlains go and tell him, right? How did they know to report Mordechai's activities to her if she had not told Mahula?
Oh, it was clear. They, as servants, remember, they, first of all, it's clear that her na'arot and she fast together, right? She says, Gam ani v'na'avotai atzun ken. It would appear that Esther found a way to surround herself with servants she could trust. By the way, if you're in a, you know, think of Henry VIII and his wives, you're going to be extremely, extremely careful if you are a king or a queen, or at least try to be very careful to surround yourself with people that you know are have your back insofar as that is possible. Because to be in a position of great power is very, very scary and precarious. And yeah, she's surrounded herself with people who are going to report to her. Maybe they don't know the exact nature of the relationship between her and Mordechai. They know something. Yeah. Is that hand up, Smira? Is that your hand up? Yeah, did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question.
Oh, wait, okay. First Mira, and then I'll take Chava's question, yeah?
I have lost the reasoning that you gave to say that Mordechai and Esther were in some way husband and wife. What do you think?
Oh, we talked about that in the session about Mordechai and Esther. Chazal explained that Esther, Rabbi Meir, explains that Esther and Mordechai were married, which, as they pointed out, they would have had to be so that he could take care of her. Otherwise, how could he raise a child by himself? Okay. Chava, there's a Chava there who raised her.
Ken,
yes.
Ken, how come Mordechai put the Jewish population in danger by acting the way Midrash, he
did? The Midrash, which we have not gotten to yet, the Midrash says, that's what the Jews say to Mordechai. What are you, crazy? What are you doing this to us for? Why are you provoking him? It seems clear that Mordechai thinks that what he's doing is not ultimately endangering the Jews. And we'll, as I said, we'll talk about that, because there's something historically significant happening here. So we'll have to look at that. That's a good question. And the Midrash highlights that. Okay, one or two more questions. Annie? Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Can you please repeat the part about Yaakov bowing to Esav and the two lineages of Haman and Mordechai?
Sure. So we know that from the story in Bereshit, Yaakov is returning home after, you know, 22 years that he has spent in the house of Lavan with his wives, his children, his wealth, right? And he comes back and he's terrified to meet his brother. He's really, really scared, right? And then we have the story of the struggle with the angel and right, all of that. Now, when he encounters his brother, what he does is he presents his family. His brother says, Mi ele lecha, who are these people, brother? Who are they? He says, oh, these are my wives and children. And as he introduces his wives and children, each wife and her children bow, including Rachel and Yosef. So Haman is saying, look, your father, your ancestor, acknowledged my ancestors' supremacy, because Haman is descended from Agag. It's what he's called, Agagi. Chazal identified that, and I think it's pretty clear from his proclivities. They identify that with Amalek, and Amalek wants to destroy Israel. Amalek is Esav's grandson, right? And he says, my ancestor, your ancestor, your great-great-great-great-grandfather bowed to my great-great-great-grandfather. So what's your problem? Why won't you bow to me?
Except that Mordechai is from Binyamin, and Binyamin didn't bow down.
That's what he answers. So that's what Mordechai answers. My father, my direct father, my tribal ancestry is such that Binyamin wasn't born yet. Which I would just say this, because we really have to stop. What Mordechai is saying here is Binyamin never had to compromise with evil. And that means I have power over you. We'll talk about that in greater detail, Bezrat Hashem, next week. We'll continue these sources, and then hopefully we'll wrap up all the things. I have to say, generally speaking, when I teach Megillat Esther, I take at least 8 sessions, and my students tend to, you know, prepare the material ahead of time. So I feel like I'm kind of shoving a lot in here, but you're a very patient and wonderful group. And you're hanging on nicely. So I'm going to shove some more in next week. Okay, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.